comes from a very, very poor working class background, and he's made it into the heart of the Swiss establishment, into the financial sector. And he is, or was for years, extremely loyal to the financial sector, unusually loyal, because he has made it out of nowhere to be a somebody. And therefore, I think it was a real shock to him when the system started to let him down, when it behaved badly. And then when he complained about that bad behaviour, when it ejected him. So I think he was completely unprepared to play this role of whistleblower. And it's taken him literally years to work out how to do it. And it's really only recently that he's understood how to do it by coming out publicly and trying to build alliances who can help him to get the truth out.
Bank Julius Baer hired lawyers in LA. And the lawyers in LA represent the Hollywood stars. They're very, very aggressive at trying to basically use abusive process to shut down publications. Their tactic was to spray out subpoenas, spray out legal demands, and move extremely quickly. So they had a court case without even us turning up, and a temporary restraining order was issued, which knocked off the WikiLeaks domain name for about 10 days.
As a grand finale, Elmer leaked the files of two big fish. The candidate for the presidency of Brazil in 2002, Rosana Sani, appeared as a beneficiary of the Coronado Trust based in Guernsey. She was forced to step down from the presidential race after police raided her company and found unexplained cash.
Rudy's business hasn't started up so well, and he's still struggling with it. So this is why I'm here, to earn some money for the family. I live with my mother-in-law, and we share a flat, basically. My social life is very limited. I work long hours, and I go back home late. I'm keeping my costs low and trying not to spend extraordinary amounts of money. What I earn here, about half of it goes back to Mauritius to support Rudy there. At the moment, I'm trying to find a flat for us to bring him back here. I'm now trying to solve a problem, basically, and keeping the family together in any way I can. It's not that I chose to do this. I'm just kind of putting back together a broken glass.
1 hour after this interview, the UK tax authorities were given a CD full of offshore banking data from the Standard Bank. Rudolf Elmer never knew if the data was used by tax authorities. Tax secrecy is just as untransparent as the sacrosanct banking secrecy.
There are very powerful organisations, by which I mean the majority of Swiss banks and British banks, that need to reassure their clients, that is tax-evading clients and criminal clients from across the world, that their personal affairs are absolutely secure and hidden behind banking secrecy legislation, not just banking secrecy legislation, but secrecy arrangements of tax havens in the Caribbean, which use trusts and offshore companies.
During my investigation, I was contacted by a friend of Rudolf Elmer. He knows the Swiss banking community and Elmer's personal story very well.
My request to you, David, is please keep my name to yourself. I'm just trying to help you understand the system. Most of the people who are actually trying to bring down the system don't want any publicity. They don't want to be public heroes. You know, most people have a very soft image of Switzerland. But the Swiss bankers can actually destroy people like Rudy to calm down others. That's why they went so bad against Rudy, because they don't want other Rudys. In the view of other employees of the Swiss banks, becoming a Rudy doesn't pay.
Flashback. After his dismissal from Julius Baer in the Cayman Islands in 2003, Elmer returned to Zurich, where he found a new job. With documents in his possession that were incriminating to the bank, he posed a threat to Julius Baer and the bank hired up to 10 private detectives to watch him.
That's the house we were living in. And I drove in this road with huge speed between 9 and 10 o'clock in the evening. And then they stopped the car abruptly here in front of the room where my little girl was. They drove in with a quite bit of speed to create that terrible noise. And then they drove back again. So and that happened on not only once, it didn't happen on twice, it happened several times. And I can recall, I would say at least about 10, 12 times, there were times when it happened three evenings in fall, or for then 2 days nothing at all, and so on. So we didn't really know what we have to expect. Stalking is, from my point of view, a crime, especially if you go after family members, after children, after neighbors. I mean, it's not one neighbor, it's another one, it's another way, down there, everyone. So it's a huge number of people who felt afraid. They drove me mad. Yeah, I was mad, to be honest. I was mad at certain points in time. Luckily, I wasn't that mad that to take any terrible action and, let's say, using a gun or anything else. I just thought, if I can stop them here, calling the police, because every time when it happened, the police was, unfortunately, too late.
I prepared a piece of wood, put nails in it, put that on the street, lying in on the meadow there, and waiting until those guys come and pull the piece of wood over the road to hurt their car, to hurt their car. And then that was interesting. I mean, it was interesting that my daughter came and said to me, Papa, what are you doing here? And then I said, okay, I lost myself again. I'm driven by action, not by logic. Today I know how to drive people mad. Yes. If you do have the money and put constantly a little bit more pressure here, a little bit more pressure there, on the employees in your office, then on your family, your daughter, then I was close. I mean, I was thinking about suicide. I was thinking about taking action against those stalkers, or taking an action against key people in the bank, because I knew Remo Bear was behind it. He knew what was going on. I knew Mike Bear was behind it. I knew Thomas Bear. Those were the guys who could have said, we stop that action. But they must have said, go on. Go on with the action, make this guy, as the head of resources told me, finish him up.
This intimidation by private detectives took place in 2004 and 2005. At that time, Rudolf Elmer and his family repeatedly filed complaints against X for harassment. But the Zurich prosecutor systematically refused to open an investigation. Rudolf Elmer then responded using the means available to him by sending his data to the Swiss tax authorities and a financial magazine.
The journalist just chose to do nothing. I mean, he didn't investigate the data. He just broke the story that the data were stolen, and that's it. Only 4 years later, when a similar CD was handed over to The Guardian, they investigated the data. They wrote about the clients, about high net worth individuals, about tax avoidance, about money laundering, all the things that 2005 weren't done.
A few weeks later, the media group Ragier, which owns Cash, covertly handed a copy of the CD to the bank.
Why did they give the CD to the bank in the first place? I mean, what about the protection of the sources? That's exactly the argument they used, not to hand over the CD to the prosecutor. So either you protect your sources from the bank and from the prosecutors, or you don't protect your sources, and then you have to hand over the CDs to everybody.
When the cash story broke, Julius Baer filed a complaint against X for breach of banking secrecy. Quickly, things are closing in towards Elmer.
Basically, what happened is I went to work, was called by a policeman, and he told me that something's wrong with my daughter, I should come home quickly. I left the office at 9 in the morning again, back to Freienbach, and then there was the police in my house. They just said they're performing a house search, and they take me now to custody.
After 2 weeks in custody, Rudolf Elmer's lawyer called for his release. The Zurich justice system then produced a document of a dubious nature.
Hello. My name is David Leloup. I'm a Belgian journalist. And I am preparing a story about Rudolf Elmer. Do you know Rudolf Elmer?
No.
The prosecutor used your name.
My name is Yolanda.
Yes. To testify against him. You don't know him. Because
Nein.
Here it's written that you are his wife.
Nein. Nein. I don't know. I don't understand it.
My name.
Yeah.
You are not the wife of Rudolf Elmer.
No.
This false evidence against Rudolf Elmer was apparently due to a copy-paste error by the Zurich Department of Justice. It was nevertheless used, along with other arguments, to keep Elmer in custody for another 2 weeks.
After the imprisonment, I had two meetings with the bank, and a representative of the bank made an offer to settle the problem. And it was a payment of around 400,000 Swiss over 5 years, every month a little portion, an installment, and then at the end some lump sum. But basically it meant over 5 years, and the idea was just that I stay quiet for those 5 years. Now what they wanted from me was that that I do accept that agreement, and all the complaints they had against me would be solved.
But Rudolf Elmer saw this offer as a means of buying his silence. So he turned it down and went into exile in Mauritius.
Future crises will identify jurisdictions that fail to cooperate, including tax havens, and take action to defend our financial system.
We have agreed that there will be an end to tax havens that do not transfer information on request. The banking secrecy of the past must come to an end.
Hello, here is Mr. Berger. I would like to have some advice on a trust issue. I'm Swiss-American and need some advice how to set up the structure or move the structure.
Yeah, sure. If you want to give me a better idea of what you're looking for, I can give you some better advice.
Yeah, I do have a Cayman Trust who holds a Swiss account, has a Swiss bank account. I'm a bit afraid of to keep the money in Switzerland. Are there options?
Well, the country that does not cooperate with either Switzerland or the United States, very, very difficult to get any information out of, is Guatemala. They don't share any information based on any tax cases, even if it's criminal.
All right.
Guatemala is very secure.
But in Guatemala, are there banks like well-known banks like HSBC, or call it Credit Suisse, or Deutsche Bank?
Yes, there are. There's one bank in particular. I can't give out the name of the bank until you're a paid client, but it's on the same level as HSBC or Credit Suisse. What we need for the bank account would be a notarized copy of your passport.
And would it be possible to have kind of a hold mail agreement with the bank? That, I mean, I don't really want that the information sent out to, let's say, over the bound to another country.
Yeah, no. You're protected by bank privacy laws of Guatemala. It would be illegal for the bank to release any information on you.
All right.
You have all ownership of the company, but the lawyer will appear for you in the public registry.
That's called a kind of a nominee, huh, isn't he? Then
that's right.
Yeah, all right. That sounds good. Yeah. And how much would it cost such a structure?
We charge $4,000 for the company and the bank account in Guatemala.
That's all in all, yeah?
All in all.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, that's very reasonable.
The offshore banking system emerged from the financial crisis stronger than ever. Once again, Rudolf Elmer looked for a way to rock the system.
Mr. Rudy Elmer, please welcome him to discuss his story, his case, and the issues it raises. Thank you, sir.
Good morning. I would like to tell you the short story first about what happened to me, and then the second part will be then about the real matter. Now, the short story is, and it's a very simple one, I was in the Cayman Islands, and there was a kind of a mouse tail. Mouse tail. I started to pull on it a bit, and it got bigger, the tail. It looked like a dragon tail. I went back to Switzerland. I started to pull on it more. I didn't stop. And it got bigger and bigger. It became a dragon. A dragon, a fire-breathing dragon with several heads. And one of the heads was the bank. One was the press, one the Swiss press up to a certain extent. Then the prosecutor, and all were after me and my family to put pressure on us.
Basically, in 2008, having exhausted the routes he sought through the bank and the Swiss courts, Mr. Elmer went to WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. Thank you for coming.
Mr. Elmer has been fighting his case for some 5 years, I believe, to, in one way or another, draw attention to this data. Of course, we don't know whether he is our source or not. We are structured in such a way that we do not know that. However, he certainly has something important, and has had something very important to say about this matter. And I understand he is in a position to have more to say and more to give to the world to help them understand these sort of corrupt practices.
This data has been collected due to my whistleblower website having had contacts with other people. I will not reveal any company names. I will not reveal any high net worth riddles. What I want to do is to hand this over to WikiLeaks, and I say that again, WikiLeaks, in order to have it investigated and making a decision on it. It's a similar thing as the first whistleblower letter I wrote.
And together to the front, guys.
I can't say more than that.
The Guardian did mention 40, as many as 40 politicians were possibly involved in this. Can you state that possibly we're talking about 40 politicians?
I made that statement, so I can state it, yes.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, knowledge. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of knowledge and its impact on the Islamic lifestyle. We know that knowledge is one of the important parts of the human life, and the human advances was based on the knowledge and the sciences. Therefore, when we look at the Islamic lifestyle and the Islamic teachings itself, we see that there is a lot of emphasis on learning and seeking knowledge. Therefore, in many verses as well as in many narrations, it is said that you should go and seek knowledge. For example, in one of the narrations of Imam Ali, he said that "Iktasibul ilma yuksibkumul hayat," that you need to seek knowledge, ilm. The word ilm is used, which is knowledge. And through this, you will seek your life. You will expand, have developments, have the developments in your life. So the knowledge is the base of all the developments that the human beings have in their lifestyle. Therefore, in the Islamic lifestyle, if we want to have developments, especially when Islam is not against the sciences, it's not against the knowledge, and it talks about the human advancements, therefore it is highly recommended in the Islamic lifestyle to seek knowledge. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of knowledge and its importance in the Islamic lifestyle. And we said in the Arabic terminology, the word which is used for knowledge is ilm. Ilm is said to a knowledge or a science or something which we learn when we practically apply those things. For example, if someone learns how to make a table, and he gets the pre-knowledge, we can say, of how to make a table. Like we need some nails, we need wood, we need hammer, maybe a glue, and there must be a specific size of that table. So we know all these things. We get this information. We have all the information, the necessary information, in order to make a table. But when someone practically changes this information into a real table, or it applies his information that he gathered into a real table, then it is known as knowledge. It is known as ilm. So we need to remember that ilm is always with the practice. And when someone practically can do or convert his information that he has gained into his practical life, then that thing becomes ilm for him, and therefore we call alim to one who has ilm. Scholar is the person who changes, who converts his information that he has, all those informations, into practice. Therefore, we need to, when we talk about the knowledge, we need to make sure that knowledge is not about reading books. Knowledge means that you practically apply what you learn, inshallah. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
At least 223 Palestinians were killed during those protests, which began on March 30, 2018 and concluded in December 2019. 7 persons with disabilities were killed during the protests, according to Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is titled, The Israeli Regime Kills People with Disabilities. Stay tuned for more. To mark International Day of Persons with Disabilities, the Israeli regime military tweeted a photo of its communications tower in Tel Aviv lit in purple. The Zionist regime military claimed that the gesture was in honor of people with disabilities in occupied territories and around the world. Twitter users quickly seized on the irony and hypocrisy by highlighting the Zionist regime's myriad crimes against Palestinians with disabilities. Earlier this week, an Israeli and Palestinian human rights group published a report exposing the Zionist regime's sham investigations into the killing and maiming of protesters during Gaza's Great March of Return. At least 223 Palestinians were killed during those protests, which began on March 30, 2018 and concluded in December 2019. 7 persons with disabilities were killed during the protest, according to Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group. A UN commission of inquiry found that the Zionist regime's snipers shot at persons with disabilities knowing they were clearly recognizable as such during the Great March of Return. Additionally, more than 13,000 Palestinians were injured during the protest, some 8,000 by live fire, about 2,400 by rubber-coated metal bullets, and almost 3,000 by tear gas canisters that hit them directly. B'Tselem and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights stated in their joint report recently, those figures do not reflect the thousands more people injured from tear gas inhalation during the protest. Of course, of the persons wounded, 156 lost limbs, the rights groups state, adding, none of these cases were investigated. B'Tselem and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights described the Zionist regime's self-investigation mechanism as a smokescreen intended to deter the scrutiny of international criminal court. The tribunal in The Hague only pursues war crimes cases when states are unwilling or unable to carry out meaningful domestic investigations. The Zionist regime is unwilling to investigate abuses against Palestinians by its forces, and therefore the responsibility to ensure accountability for these violations now lies with the ICC, B'Tselem stated. Extrajudicial execution of Iyad Hallaq is an example. Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, has called for a war crimes investigation into the killing of Iyad Hallaq by the Zionist regime police in Al-Quds last year. Hallaq, 31, was walking to a school for persons with disabilities that he attended when he was gunned down. The Zionist regime has withheld surveillance camera footage from the area where Halak was killed and imposed a gag order on Halak family's lawyer to prevent information about court proceedings from being made public, according to Al-Haq. The Zionist regime systematically resorts to excessive use of force, including against Palestinians with disabilities. 10 Palestinians with disabilities were killed by occupation forces in the West Bank and Gaza in 2018 alone. Persons with disabilities were among the more than 250 Palestinians killed during the Zionist regime's 11-day attack on Gaza in May. Iyad Salha, who used a wheelchair, was killed in an Israeli regime airstrike on his home on May 19th. Amani Mahawish, Iyad's wife, who was 8 months pregnant, was killed along with their 2-year-old daughter, Nagam. Salha was among 6 people with disabilities killed during the offensive, according to Medical Aid for Palestinians, citing the Palestinian Medical Relief Society and National Society for Rehabilitation. The bombardment also affected several health and rehabilitation facilities, including 24 organizations working with people with disabilities, Medical Aid for Palestinians added. Some 3,000 people with disabilities were displaced within Gaza during the bombardment. Palestinians with disabilities experience severe difficulty evacuating civilian buildings under attack, increasing the risk of injury and death. Medical Aid for Palestinians noted earlier this year, deaf people in Gaza had difficulty accessing information during those terrifying 11 days. "I felt that I was in terrible danger whenever the house shook," Saadia Meghdad, who is deaf, told the Electronic Intifada earlier this year, adding, "But I did not know where the bombs were landing." Older people are also acutely vulnerable during the Zionist regime's attacks on Gaza, coordinated from Tel Aviv Military Command Tower, illuminated in purple. "Wars take a heavy toll on us," Ishaq al-Sayyid told the Electronic Intifada in July, adding, "They deprive us of any sense of comfort or safety. I am still in a state of anxiety following the May attack." The consulate said it was proud to be working with a Palestinian group to enhance the rights and inclusion of people with disabilities in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, however, the UK government has allied with the Zionist regime against accountability for all Palestinians, including those with disabilities, by opposing the investigation underway at the International Criminal Court, ICC. Karim Khan, a British national, began his term as ICC chief prosecutor in June. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that he hoped that the election of Khan and another Briton as a judge would help serve reform at a court. Human Rights Watch condemned Johnson's remark as a brazen assault on ICC independence. EU sponsors Solidarity Film Festival is another example in this regard. The UK isn't alone in its empty gestures toward human rights while helping the Zionist regime consolidate the prevailing situation of impunity. The European Union is sponsoring, along with various Zionist regime agencies, the upcoming Solidarity Film Festival in Tel Aviv that it says puts human rights at the forefront. Sponsorship of the festival is a rejection of the Palestinian call for a cultural boycott of the Zionist regime. The cultural boycott call is inspired by the global movement that helped end apartheid in South Africa. Meanwhile, the EU has yet to reject and condemn the Zionist regime's use of a draconian anti-terror law against six Palestinian human rights and social service organizations. Three of the groups, including Al-Haq, Al-Damir, and Defense for Children International Palestine, are assisting the International Criminal Court's war crimes investigation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The cinematic where the EU-sponsored festival is to be held is a convenient 5-minute walk from the Zionist regime military headquarters in Tel Aviv. Presumably, Palestinian film fans in the West Bank will not be allowed to pass through military checkpoints to attend the Tel Aviv festival. That would be too much human rights and solidarity to expect from the Zionist regime and the EU.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Before we deal with the law of istihada and fluid discharge, which is the topic today and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh, we have started, in fact, a series of episodes on the, discharge or the blood discharge, whether it is regular or irregular. We started off with the istihada, the irregular blood discharge. Let me ask you this question at the start of this program. Is istihada the only irregular blood discharge, or we have other types of irregular blood which you distinguished from the regular type of blood discharge which every lady is familiar with by the name of the menses, or for example the monthly period?
Yeah, the term regular and irregular may be confusing for many ladies and girls. Regular blood, when we talk of regular blood, we mean the regular monthly discharge or the monthly period that a woman gets on a monthly basis.
Mm-hmm.
Irregular blood is the blood which is discharged by a woman and it is less than 2 days, okay? It the blood discharge happens mm-hmm. off and on, but it's not more than 3 days, okay. It could be sometimes more than 3 days because maybe a woman might have, got through the monthly discharge and she is now continuously bleeding, okay.
Mm-hmm.
If a woman is continuously bleeding, the extra blood is considered irregular blood and it's called istihada blood. Even if it continues for, let's say, for 20 days, some ladies might discharge blood throughout the month, you know,
wow.
because of some abnormality or uh-huh. some kind of disorder
or malfunction.
They are facing. So the extra blood, the blood which is discharged out of the monthly period, is called irregular blood. But it's not the blood which comes from a wound. For example, if a woman has internal injuries or wounds, okay. And she is bleeding. This is not considered to be irregular blood because the blood of wound is different. Yes. It has nothing to do with the irregular blood.
But see? When you said that a woman may discharge blood, in fact, irregularly for even a period of 20 days, that would be very difficult to distinguish and, in fact, tell difference between. Whether it is regular or irregular,
because
we have other like types of discharge, the blood discharge. For example, if I may recall, correct me if I'm wrong. We had a program on this on the menstruation of the ladies, and you said between 3 days and 10 days, something around that
three
time.
3 days and it's not less than 3 days,
yes.
and not more than 10 days,
yes,
yeah.
So that would be the monthly period.
Yeah, that's the monthly period.
But when you are talking about like the irregular blood discharge, which we call istihada,
yes.
Do you mean that even if a lady, for example, may have this kind of blood discharge irregularly for about like this range, mm-hmm. like 3 to 10 days, then it would be too hard to decipher, right?
You're right. You know. A woman is supposed to have a fixed period of time for, for menstruation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say a woman knows that on the 20th of every month she discharges, she gets her monthly period.
Okay.
Okay. So from the 20th until the 10th of that month, she's supposed to be in her monthly period. She's menstruating.
Yes.
And if she happens to discharge blood beyond the 10th day,
mm-hmm.
then even if it continues for 20 days or even for more, then that blood is supposed to be the blood of istihaza, okay? Mm-hmm. So she has to, of course, perform ghusl or act according to the rules of istihaza, because right. A woman who is in the state of istihaza is supposed to pray, she is supposed to fast if she's in the month of Ramadan, and she is supposed to act like an ordinary, regular woman who is praying, who is fasting, and who is performing her religious duties.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are still at the presence of Sheikh Javid talking to us about istihaza, the irregular blood discharge, according to Ayatollah Sistani's fatwas. Sheikh, let me ask you this question in this part of our program, Islamic Laws. Well, is it obligatory for a lady, let's say, to perform ghusl in the state of istihaza, this irregular blood discharge?
Well, depending on the type of blood she discharges, because we had three types of irregular blood,
mm-hmm.
Little, medium, and excessive. Now, if a woman is in the state of little istihaza, and she is, for example, spotting and seeing and discharging blood off and on, and of course, as we gave the example of a pad she wears, that pad is stained on the surface, okay?
Yes.
Stained with blood on the surface. Then obviously in this situation, the woman is not supposed to perform ghusl. She has to make wudu, one wudu for every single prayer.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
this is very important. One wudu for every single prayer.
Even if there isn't any discharge in the middle, between the two units.
Even if there is no discharge, because she's in the state of nifas, she must make one, because she's discharging blood off and on. Okay,
uh-huh.
She discharges blood now, but after 1 hour, she does not discharge any blood, and then after another hour, she might discharge blood again. So she has to make one udu for every single prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when she is discharging little blood.
Yes.
Blood.
Little.
And it does not make any difference whether she is offering a wajib salat or a qadha prayer or a mustahab prayer, mm-hmm. or a nafila prayer or any kind
obligatory
of prayer.
Obligatory, recommended, no matter what.
She has to make one wudu for every single prayer if the blood she discharges is little.
Okay. But still another question may pop up here, and that is... if the same lady is discharging blood at the same time, like she wants to say the prayer or offer the prayer,
mm-hmm.
and she's discharging now, can she or is she allowed to offer the prayer while discharging the blood?
Oh, well, she...
or she has to stop, like discharging, and then
right.
Start praying.
You're right. You know, if she knows she is discharging blood, first of all, she has to remove the pad,
mm-hmm.
wash herself,
uh-huh.
and of course change the pad, okay, or whatever, which is stained with blood, because she cannot pray with the blood coming or with the blood on the pad. she is wearing. So she has to change or renew the pad, and then continue continue with her prayer. So the answer to your question is that she should do whatever she can to prevent the flow of the blood.
Mm-hmm. I see. You also talked about the the rule or the law for the little istihadha.
Yeah.
But what about the other forms of istihadha?
Good.
All right. We have only 1 minute.
We have covered little istihadha, but as far as medium istihadha is concerned, of course, a woman has to perform one ghusl for the medium istihadha,
uh-huh.
Okay? One ghusl. Now, if
for each unit of prayer?
No. For the whole
uh-huh.
24 hours, okay?
I see.
If she wakes up in the morning and finds herself in the state of medium istihadha, she has to perform ghusl for the fajr prayer, and that ghusl is sufficient. But then she has to make one wudu for every prayer. Okay, she has to make wudu, and wudu is necessary. Wudu is a part of the obligation. One ghusl is enough, but then she has to make wudu for every single prayer. And
it's not like the janaba ghusl,
of course, when you are in this state.
Yes.
This is a very important point. Maybe we will discuss it further in the following episode.
Yes, inshallah.
But then, if a woman happens to be in the month of Ramadan and she wakes up, and to her surprise she sees, for example, some kind of blood on the pad she's wearing, she is not supposed to break her fast, because she must observe fast, and ghusl is not obligatory for the fast. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Because her fast remains valid.
It has nothing to do with fasting.
Yeah.
Only what we are talking about is related to prayer.
To prayer.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.